Here on Stolen Lives, we discuss brutal and heartbreaking crimes against children. Themes may include child murder, torture, and sexual, domestic, and child abuse. I do try my best to remain respectful for the babies in these stories and leave out unnecessary details that honestly, none of us need to know to understand the frustration of why and how this ever happened. However, if you find any of these themes triggering, this podcast may not be for you. Listener discretion is advised. August 2017, Littleton, Colorado. A 7-year-old girl dies from a terminal illness, one that she had spent most of her short life fighting. After her death, however, her mother's strange behaviours led investigators to exhuming her body, which revealed the sickening truth. This is Olivia's story.
Olivia Grant of Colorado has a rare neurogastrointestinal disease, but still made a bucket list of some things she would like to accomplish. One of those things was to be a firefighter. A local firehouse picked her up to report for duty. She greeted her team and even got to battle a real fire. Another bucket list item? To catch a bad guy with police. Olivia's mom says her condition makes it difficult for her to remember everyday things. But every time she checks another accomplishment off her list, a photo gets hung in her room where she's now on hospice care to remind her of all the good days she's had and all the people who cared enough to help her live her dreams.
Olivia Kelly Gant was born June 21, 2010 in Pasadena, Texas, to parents Kelly Turner Gant and Jeff Gant. She was the youngest of three daughters born to the couple. However, Kelly and Jeff's marriage was one marred with frequent explosive arguments, their relationship ending while Olivia was only 2 years old. Kelly retained custody of the children, moving with the three girls from Texas to Littleton, Colorado. And even though both sets of grandparents remained in Texas, they would make the effort to visit with the girls often. Olivia was particularly close with her paternal stepfather, Lonnie Gertrue. Both Lonnie and his wife, Trinelle, would be regular visitors to the home to spend time with their grandchildren. They would watch movies together. Lonnie would recount that Olivia only had to watch a movie once, and then the next time they watched it, she could recite the entire dialogue word for word. Lonnie would later remember his youngest granddaughter as being a loving child. Quote, "She just had a great imagination and she loved playing with her dolls." Unquote. This was a clever little girl who was obviously destined for greatness. January 2013, 2-year-old Olivia started to get sick, more often than those normal toddler runny noses and coughs. And like any concerned mother, Kelly took Olivia to the Children's Hospital, Colorado, for a checkup after Olivia became severely constipated. Kelly told the doctors that she thought her daughter wasn't digesting food properly, and this seemed to match with what the doctors found. A hardened stool in the girl's colon. Nothing too serious at all. And after this, the doctors told Kelly that Olivia should make a full recovery. But then she didn't. And from April of that same year, Kelly would return with Olivia to the hospital repeatedly, insisting the same issue was still happening. That her daughter wasn't eating and her food wasn't digesting properly. The issue continued with such regularity that in 2014, doctors operated on Olivia to help resolve the issue, rerouting her small intestine through her large intestine, the waste being diverted to a bag attached to her stomach. And it seemed, for a while anyway, that Olivia's medical problems were managed. Olivia wasn't getting sick, and she was able to attend pre-K and then to kindergarten at Columbine Hills Elementary School. Here, everybody loved her, the teachers, staff, and other students. And Olivia was thriving at school. She was a smart little girl that was excelling in her class. But Kelly started taking Olivia back to the hospital. She told doctors that while, yes, the surgery did help alleviate some of the symptoms, she believed Olivia was still having digestive problems. In a 5-year period, until she was 7 years old, Olivia Gant had made more than 1,000 trips to the hospital. And in those 5 years, doctors did all they could to treat the symptoms and to find out what was wrong with the little girl. Olivia had multiple kinds of feeding tubes implanted because Kelly insisted that her daughter wasn't able to feed properly. They tried different feeding methods to see if any would work for Olivia. Kelly told doctors that the only thing that worked for the 7-year-old was intravenous nutrition, or TPN, and so doctors installed the tube. But that wasn't the only medical problem that Olivia was experiencing now. During this time, Olivia had also been prescribed heavy narcotic medication, as well as Keppra, a strong anti-seizure medication. Although none of the doctors had actually witnessed Olivia having a seizure, Kelly had assured them that these were frequent. The doctors had just taken her word for it. Olivia would also be diagnosed with a number of allergies to peanuts, tree nuts, chocolate, milk protein, cats, and pollen. Kelly also reported Olivia had been diagnosed with autism at some point. Now, my eldest is on the spectrum and he has some food sensitivity. Certain foods, textures or combinations have been no-go since he was just eating solids. So even before the feeding tube was placed, Olivia had an extremely limited diet with poor nutrition. And because of her allergies, the feeding tube was only giving her a small percentage of what she needed to be healthy. During her many trips to the hospital, medical staff had given Olivia the nickname Princess, because the little girl preferred to wear princess dresses instead of the hospital gowns. And because she had been to the hospital so many times, nurses and doctors had become fond of her. I mean, how could you not? She was an incredibly bubbly and sweet child that you could just easily adore. When not in the hospital, Olivia loved nothing more than playing with her two older sisters, trying to keep up with them and do everything they were doing. She loved watching movies. Kelly would pack a portable DVD player and all her favourite movies for those long hospital stays. Olivia was known to be extremely imaginative. She loved talking non-stop with her friends and family. She was a highly spirited little girl. When not at the hospital, Olivia would often go to the Dairy Queen for her favourite treat, vanilla ice cream cones. Olivia loved going to the zoo to visit the lions, her favourite animal, or to Dinosaur Ridge. Olivia was also heavily interested in dinosaurs and sharks.
Buy my cake to help kids.
She was just a joy to be around. She was so energetic, so loving and caring, and loved to play. She just loved life so much.
Lonnie Gautreau was Olivia's grandfather. He called her Livy. She called him Pawpaw.
Pawpaw's going to take your picture.
Kelly would often take photos of her young daughter to document all of Olivia's hospital visits. These photos showed Olivia sitting in her wheelchair or propped up in a bed amongst her horde of stuffed animals. Olivia loved Disney. She would often be seen wearing outfits with Disney characters. And Kelly would share all of these photos online in a blog. Kelly using this as an outlet for her emotions as a mother of a terminal child. On these posts, she explained that Olivia had medical issues since she was just 9 months old. She had all sorts of diagnosis, from hydrophilus seizure disorder, heart problems, brain malformations, and intestinal issues. We are just going to take a quick break now for a word from one of our sponsors. This blog quickly gained traction, and many people from the community wanted to know how they could help. And because the young girl was so sick, Kelly would turn to multiple charity organisations to arrange for them to provide Olivia with special events, gifts and fun experiences. These types of charities, such as Make-A-Wish Foundation, they allowed Olivia to fulfil her bucket list of all the things she wanted to do before she died. Olivia got to pretend to be a cop and catch the bad guy, help a hurt animal, and to be a firefighter for the day. For one of her birthdays, one of the charities hosted a special birthday party for the young girl. They combined Batman with Disney princesses, two of Olivia's favourite things, and they raised a total of $11,000. She was given so many amazing gifts and opportunities, all because of her terminal illness. And this was all followed by the public through regular appearances on local news outlets.
She is a ball of fire. Today, her wish came true to become a firefighter. She's in intestinal failure, and we don't know how much longer she has.
And so we made a bucket list, and one of her things was to become a firefighter.
Want to see how far we can get it to go?
When we found out that she wanted to do this, we were very thrilled to be able to help out.
I mean, I don't even have words to describe how I feel. It's just a bunch of ball of emotion.
So here's my bucket list. Be a fireman.
We got to do that, so they have to check it out.
Thanks for being
awesome. I was resting for a while so I can feel good.
The outpouring of support that our little community has given, you just can never repay that.
In 2017, it seemed as if Olivia's medical conditions were worsening. March 2017, Olivia underwent another surgery. This time because Kelly told doctors that her daughter's bladder wasn't functioning properly. So doctors inserted a tube that led from her bladder to an opening in her abdomen to allow urine to be drained through a catheter. Although it did appear that Olivia never went through any toilet training or learned how to use a bathroom at all. Because at almost 7 years old, she was still wearing a diaper. Not long after this, Kelly reported that Olivia was rejecting all the treatments and that she was seeking a DNR order, or a do not resuscitate order, for her young daughter. She also insisted the hospital remove Olivia's TPN feeding tube. But the medical staff knew that in doing so, then Olivia would die because she would no longer be receiving the proper nutrition. As it was, she was only receiving a third of the required nutrition she needed. And because of that, doctors refused to sign the DNR. They knew it would kill Olivia. It was basically a death sentence. This only angered Kelly, because they were refusing to do what she wanted for her daughter. She was determined to find someone to sign the paperwork for the order, and I must give it to her for her tenacity, because Kelly was successful. The hospital decided to change Olivia's doctor to a new one, and this new doctor agreed to sign the paperwork. As soon as Kelly had the DNR order, she immediately had Olivia's TPN tube removed. The young girl was put in hospice care, August 1st, 2017. At first, Olivia seemed all right. Kelly filmed herself singing a Hakuna Matata from The Lion King with her daughter and published it all on her social media. It was one of the many video clips Kelly posted online, chronicling Olivia's illness over the years. These videos would also be used to try and get donations from fundraising websites. During the first part of her hospice stay, Olivia had been awake and alert, but unfortunately things took a turn for the worst, because Olivia's feeding tube had been removed. She was only being fed melted popsicle juice, rubbed onto her lips with a sponge. Olivia Gant was literally being starved to death. The only other thing that she was given was the large doses of medication she'd been prescribed. Olivia's grandfather Lonnie said of his visits with her, his granddaughter was still lucid, but she had told her grandfather that she was really hungry. He had been deeply upset to see his young granddaughter so sick, knowing she would die soon. August 20th, 2017. 7-year-old Olivia Gant passed away. It had been about 3 weeks since her feeding tube had been removed and since she had been placed in hospice care. Olivia's official cause of death had been intestinal failure, a direct complication from her medical conditions. Olivia's death certificate also listed that she'd been autistic and had a seizure disorder. It was a deeply sad day for Olivia's loved ones when the young girl finally passed. But as the child was terminally ill, it was something they were all prepared for. They all knew Olivia was going to pass at a young age because of her terminal illness. Many would think that her tragic death would have been the end of the story. A young child falls ill and is treated to the best of the hospital's ability. They were able to care for her until her eventual death at only 7 years old. It was a real tragedy to see a child like Olivia dying at such a young age. The family grieves, mourning the life she could have lived. She was buried and they were forced to move on. But that isn't the end of the story. If it was, I wouldn't be telling you this story today. A little more than a year after young Olivia's tragic death, October 2018, Kelly brought her oldest daughter to the hospital. She was claiming that her child was experiencing bone pain and that she was extremely concerned about her. She told the medical staff that her daughter had cancer in the past, that she had suffered lymphoma and had been through chemotherapy and radiotherapy. Now, lymphoma is one of the most common types of childhood cancers. Basically, lymphoma is cancer of the white blood cells, which occurs when these cells start growing in an uncontrolled way, causing the lymph nodes all throughout the body to swell. Now, the doctors were suspicious of Kelly's story, and upon inspecting the young girl, the doctor sensed that something was awry. It was unusual that another one of Kelly's daughters had fallen unwell, especially after this sudden cancer diagnosis. She didn't appear to have cancer in the past, and so the doctors decided to check into it. But there was no record of this girl being treated with chemotherapy or radiotherapy anywhere. So now the doctors began to suspect that Kelly had been playing a part in Olivia's supposed illnesses, and that now she was trying to orchestrate her older daughter's illnesses as well. When they called the Prior Hospital to verify Kelly's story about her daughter having cancer, they were easily able to prove that Kelly was lying about Olivia's sister being sick. And as soon as the hospital staff were able to disprove Kelly's claims, they called social services and reported her. Now, because they were able to prove that Kelly's daughter was not actually sick like she claimed, the hospital started to take a much closer look at Olivia's medical history. For 5 long years, the child had been in and out of hospital, on heavy medication, with feeding tubes, and then starved to death in hospice. What had once been looked at as a tragic death was now being investigated as a possible case of Munchausen's by proxy. And this was how Kelly was finally caught. Had she not brought in her second daughter for medical attention, she might have got away with her crimes. Olivia Gent had been buried at the Seven Stones Chatfield Cemetery. Her body was exhumed so that an autopsy could be performed. The authorities were trying to determine what exactly killed the 7-year-old. Unfortunately, the autopsy results were inconclusive. Kelly was interviewed by authorities, and she completely unprompted brings up Munchausen's by proxy, that she knows what it means when a parent or caregiver makes her child sick on purpose in order to get attention, that they could ask anyone who stood by her side throughout Olivia's illness, and they would support that what happened had happened. Now, while they were doing this investigation, Kelly's 2 other children were removed from her care, the children placed with relatives. Their identities were kept out of the media for their own protection. Kelly's older daughter, the one she had taken to hospital with symptoms similar to Olivia's, had not experienced any more symptoms since the hospital had discovered that Kelly was lying. Her oldest daughter simply wasn't sick, and as it seemed, Olivia had not been sick either. Everything Kelly had put her through, the thousands of hospital stays, the unneeded medication and the surgeries, it had all been done to a healthy child. And for 3 agonising long weeks, young Olivia had been forced into starvation until it eventually killed her. Her death had been preventable, Olivia Gant just being another missed case of Munchausen's by proxy by doctors and other medical professionals. Over the years, there have been other cases of Munchausen's by proxy in the media. Children dying or forced to undergo surgeries and treatments because of their parents' mental illness. The most well-known would be Gypsy Rose Blanchard. Gypsy Rose has a similar story to Olivia Gant. They were both forced to be sick from a young age by their mother and had multiple unnecessary treatments. Gypsy Rose had also received gifts and special events from charitable organisations. One of the only real differences between the 2 cases was that Olivia died at a young age before anyone was able to intervene. Gypsy Rose found out what her mother was doing to her and took matters into her own hands. She was jailed from getting her boyfriend to help murder her mother. Gypsy Rose has since been released. And there are other truly horrifying cases, such as 5-year-old Garnett Spears. His mother, Lacey Spears, had been struggling to care for her child as a single mother, especially since Garnett was extremely ill. Lacey had created this whole story about her son's dead biological father. She had been staying in housing specifically for people with disabilities. She'd even created a blog about her son's health. Here, she detailed his medical history and her struggles to find out what was wrong with him. But eventually, it was discovered that Lacey Spears had been injecting Garnett's feeding tube with table salt since he was a baby. He had ended up getting encephalitis, which killed him. Garnett Spears dying January 23rd, 2014. His mother, Lacey Spears, was charged with second-degree murder and first-degree manslaughter. She was given a 20-year prison sentence. Another equally disturbing case of Munchausen's by proxy is that of Shauna Taylor and her children. 40-year-old Shauna Taylor and her husband Bill had 10 children together. They would move around the United States frequently. In 2013, Shauna brought her baby daughter to the hospital because her baby was extremely sick. Shauna continued to bring her baby to the emergency department for multiple visits, telling doctors that her baby had a great deal of medical symptoms. She would give her baby Tylenol while she was at the hospital. By the third hospital visit, her unnamed baby had been diagnosed with severe liver damage. She had started online fundraising campaigns to raise money for her sick child. The staff became suspicious of the baby's unusually high iron levels. The authorities received multiple anonymous tips that Shauna had Munchausen's by proxy and that she had been abusing her daughter. And this would turn out to be correct. Shauna had been poisoning her daughter with Tylenol and iron supplements. The baby was immediately removed from Shauna's care. As soon as the baby was taken away from her mother, her liver went back to normal and thankfully she survived. Two of Shauna's now adult children have come forward and stated they'd been medically and physically abused under Shauna's care. And it hadn't been just them. All 10 of her children had suffered. Shauna's children appeared on the Dr. Phil TV show. They spoke about how their mother kept them locked in dog cages, fed insulin, forced to take unnecessary prescription medications, and had multiple unneeded spinal taps. Shauna had tried to poison her other children's livers and would beat them. The abuse had been so bad that many of her children had been removed from her care in both California and Arizona. 5 years after she poisoned her daughter, Shauna Taylor was given a 12-year prison sentence for aggravated child abuse. Bill Taylor would claim to have zero knowledge that his wife had been poisoning their daughter, and he had been bemused as to why his children kept getting sick. He had spent a great deal of the time outside of their house for work and claimed not to have witnessed anything that went on in the household. Because the police believed that Bill had not known what was going on, he was not sentenced. Regardless whether he knew or not, his children broke contact with him after everything had occurred. 2018. Kelly Turner Gant was arrested. She was charged with the first-degree murder of Olivia, as well as a long list of felony charges. During the 5 years that little Olivia had been hospitalised, Kelly had relied on online fundraising, charities, as well as Medicaid to pay for her child's medical needs. Kelly was being charged with fraud for taking money from these organisations, as well as a Heffelbauer funeral home and Seven Stones Cemetery that had supported the family when Olivia had died. 2021, Olivia's paternal grandfather, Lonnie, filed a civil suit against the Children's Hospital Colorado for $25 million. He was understandably extremely upset that the hospital had not done more to protect Olivia when Kelly had initially brought her in for treatment. During an interview with CBS News, Lonnie said the following: "The lies were discovered too late. That would have saved her life. She would still be with us today. We would have had custody of her, and she would still be with us." There were multiple red flags, and the medical staff should have taken a closer look at the case before putting Olivia on such heavy drugs and performing so many surgeries. For example, when Kelly had claimed her child was having seizures, but the doctors had never actually seen the seizures firsthand. They really didn't have any evidence that Olivia had any, but had simply gone on Kelly's word. More than 1,000 hospital visits, and the hospital staff had never even considered Munchausen's by proxy as a possible culprit. The hospital eventually settled out of court for an undisclosed amount of money. In a different interview, Lonnie said the following: "I don't ever want this to happen to another child, and whatever it takes to get that policy change, it needs to be done. One call could have saved that child's life." Investigators spoke to a doctor in Texas who saw Olivia at birth and when she was a baby. They never diagnosed her with any of the conditions Kelly claimed her daughter had. In fact, on all of her medical files, she is listed as a healthy baby who is growing appropriately and meeting all her expected milestones. She may have had some mild developmental delays, but they were all within her age range, and nothing was ever severe enough to warrant an official diagnosis. when staff at Children's Hospital Colorado were interviewed by reporters. They stated that there had been some people who suspected that Kelly had been exaggerating her daughter's symptoms, or even lying altogether about Olivia being sick. But even though Colorado had mandatory reporting laws, they had chosen not to notify the authorities or the Department of Human Services about what was going on. For 5 long years, the hospital continued to treat Olivia as a patient as her health continued to decline. Her death could have been preventable if someone had stood up to Kelly and reported what was going on. Lonnie stated that it was only after Olivia had died that the hospital staff had gone on record, telling him that they believed she hadn't been terminally ill. He felt an extreme amount of guilt for believing Kelly when she told everyone that Olivia was terminally ill. He kept thinking back to when Olivia told him she was hungry while in hospice care. Kelly had insisted that he could only feed her melted popsicle juice, that Olivia wasn't allowed any food. Since learning the truth about his granddaughter's illnesses being faint, Lonnie has been haunted by the fact that he withheld food from her. And that Olivia had suffered for 5 long years before dying of starvation.
Was that when he came in, it appeared he had a lot of sedating type medications, and we had been slowly withdrawing some of those medications. We were still giving some of them, but at decreased doses. And as we did that, Amanda was perking back up and was awake and talking to people and was interactive with people and seemed, you know, to kind of go back to the patient that we knew or were familiar with, I guess. And at that point, I believe Kelly wanted to continue with the hospice care and wanted to start withdrawing other care, such as feedings and things like that. And when that happened, some of my nursing staff came to me, and they were somewhat upset with that decision. They didn't feel that that seemed appropriate based off of where I currently was. I mean, at that point, she was asking, you got to go home. She definitely, I think, more interactive and more engaging. And they came to me and were concerned with that. Ethics did come in and explain, you know, based off of her diagnosis, based off the symptoms that we feel like she's experiencing at home, from information that we had gathered from Kelly, that this was appropriate, that it meant a definition of being something that would be life-ending. And so, based off of the information that they had, that's why they were supporting that decision. Most parents are really invested in us doing everything possible for their kids, sometimes even beyond the point that it's not going to be beneficial anymore and it's not going to be helpful. And even when you try to convince, you know, to say, if you really want this, we'll do this, but it's not, like, going to change the outcome. It's not going to, I mean, they are so invested in prolonging their child's life and doing everything possible, you know, to be hopeful and to think, you know, if we hang on a little bit longer, there might be a new med, a new, you know, that's kind of what most parents are going for. I mean, and I never got that feeling from Kelly. We did have a meeting with them, and she did express, you know, extreme discomfort that she really did not feel that Kelly was making the appropriate decision. And what the CAP team asked us, they said for us to be able to report it, like we can't report a feeling, I think was basically their response. Like, what evidence do you have of that? Has Kelly said anything to you? Has about anything. And like, they asked a lot of questions as far as kind of like, we need to have some type of, I don't know if evidence is a good way to put, but it's kind of that, like, we have to have something to support while we are reporting, or we can't report. And I think she just, like, we couldn't come up with concrete examples or evidence, I guess is the thing, other than this doesn't feel right, this is not like it normally is for other kids, this, like, we're just not positive we believe Kelly anymore. And Captain was kind of like, well, we have to have more than
that. I did believe her because there were discrepancies that just didn't quite make sense. And in medicine, the tests are not perfect. We have stuff like this all the time that you're like, well, really? Maybe we should repeat that test because it doesn't make sense, right?
Yeah.
But it was just one after another, right? You know, when you ask for the small bowel transit looks amazing. And, you know, this, there's a stool coming out of every orifice. Nobody sees that. Comes into the hospital several times and nobody notes that or writes that down, right? Then, of course, the death note. And then I see that, there's more and more. And she's, oh, no, we're using it very sparingly. But I can see is, you know, with dark glasses playing in her computer, not the same. There was playing with me, right?
Yeah.
I mean, Monday morning quarterback, right, at the time. In fact, just in the hospital. Just had surgery, right?
Yeah.
So there's always a feasible or possible explanation. Pain, we have no test for pain, right? So the mother said, she's in terrible pain. And then I even said, looks pretty good. Oh, a good day. 30 doctors might have taken care of this kid or more.
Yes.
And somehow, right?
Yeah.
She navigated these waters. Well, I have to say, I think that this is the perfect diagnosis to lie.
Why do you say that?
Because our tests for motility are far from perfect, right? And motility testing is already compromised by a child that has a lot of surgery and narcotics, and, right? So now you don't even know if it's cause or effect, right?
Yeah.
It's very hard to make a diagnosis, the plumbing part of it. For pain, we have nothing, right? Nothing. You just have to take somebody's word for it. It's very easy. It's very easy to lie. And if you read Rob's first notes for a long time, he's constipated.
Yeah.
Like a million other kids. It's chronic constipation, mostly from probably withholding.
Yeah.
That's all. And then it escalates and it escalates and escalates. And this medical system that is so divided with so many specialists now that you will have 30 people involved, right? And we're not having medical meetings all in one room. I don't know half the doctors that have taken care of right? It's just the size.
Yeah.
So, of course we're not in communication. The he says, she says, so easy.
Okay.
If she says, oh, the surgeon said this, unfortunately, I'm probably not going to take the time to call the surgeon and say, did you really say that? Because we just can't, or we don't. I mean, unless we suspect. I think we didn't detect it in time.
Heroic doses of narcotics. Heroic doses. Though you sneak up on that, right? You know,
yeah.
So, although that, none of us would survive, I don't think, the doses that she was receiving for,
yeah.
Even if we split them, okay,
yeah.
Between the three of us.
Yeah.
But that was a scenario where I was really taken aback, and I'm saying, well, all right, well, this girl stood up on the gurney and gave me a hug, if I remember correctly, in the ER at the time of admission, and I'm saying, okay, well, where does the DNR come from, and who does not have a quality of life, and all of this piece, and I had frank conversations with Mom. It went kind of shockingly well. I think palliative care was there with this when I had to tell her that I'm not comfortable with this. I cannot sign this DNR. And I told her I can't trust you to tell me that it has no quality of life, all right? And I think I probably said, it doesn't matter who you are. you know, I'm not going to trust you to be the only voice for me, and tell me that that he doesn't deserve everything that we would offer for another child here. And we also talked about, well, what do you do in this scenario? Okay, and there were some meetings, and I called an ethics consult, and had meetings with palliative care, and then eventually with a colleague who took over her care, because I just wasn't comfortable with that scenario. And in those conversations, we talked about, well, what do you do with this, right? You know, where you don't know. And I was clear about, all right, I don't know. Intestinal failure has dysmotility or not. And there is no test I can do to do that other than to challenge this. And we had conversations, and I don't even remember who was involved in which ones, but about, well, okay, you hospitalize. Well, if you hospitalize, and a parent, Kelly or otherwise, is in that room at all, okay, well, that's not going to be a very good test, right? So what, do you remove home and do you put another placement? And wow, that's an enormous step. I think the last admission, there was close to, despite the many, the many hours that day, there really was no substantial discussion about signs or symptoms there. It was really all about, okay, we have a DNR, this is a horrible situation in my mind, and I don't think we should have a DNR, and I can't find anyone who could tell me why we should have a DNR. And I sought out people who knew her, and that was the focus of the last admission. And in the end, you know, I remain very, very uncomfortable with the situation and care. I mean, I've never been in a situation where I refuse somebody's care. I've never heard of that before.
Say mom has kid's best interest in heart. And we've done what we can medically speaking, and we will respect the wishes to transfer to hospice and withdraw care. Or we call DHS and pursue Munchausen's diagnosis. And that, as I'm sure you guys know, is a significant uphill battle without wonderful documentation, and no one felt like that was, you know, they're never cut and dried, but no one felt it fit the right picture for that. You know, people that knew her, mom was a little quirky. She might have had a bipolar or personality type disorder, but that doesn't mean that she doesn't have best interest in heart. So we couldn't base our decision on a perceived mental health diagnosis she may or may not have. I guess in hindsight, we maybe made the wrong choice. But at the time, and everybody I talked to, including our ethics team, including our GI service, we all felt that we didn't really have this. This was the right decision. You know, that it was our decision to allow her to pursue this, and that she had interests at heart were in alignment with proper medical care. And I think we all kind of begrudgingly agreed that we had to respect that, and we let it happen. I even went and saw hospice, and Kelly was appropriate. She was distraught, but at peace with her decision. I don't know that we would have done anything different put in that situation. Obviously, hindsight 2020. But again, you know, as much as I can be off the record, I feel absolutely terrible about this. And you know, it's the what if, what could we have done differently? How could we have seen this coming? What could we have done? Could we have prevented this? Could we have gotten obviously someone involved earlier, maybe? And you know. Well, I guess basically we call Child Protective Services, and they take it from there. And for what it's worth, I have a social worker on my team. We definitely have times when we call them. It is not to fault the system. It's very hit or miss. I've had families in Stapleton have their kids taken away because they're playing in the park across the street. I've had kids of meth addicts who the report was filed 3 times and nothing happened. So it's not a perfect system by any means. No system is, but it's a really tough thing to do, because what I'm basically saying, if I'm going to say we're going to go down Munchausen's route, I'm saying you're not parenting your child correctly. Not only that, but you are putting them in harm's way. We're taking your child away, and investigating them. Because if we do open a CPS case, the first thing they're going to do is that investigation. And we've got to have documentation in place, And if I just started now, say day one of where you want to do this, I better have great records going back a long time. I better have a lot of places where I said this doesn't feel right. There's a split between medical and what mom's saying. And I don't know that any of us had that enough to really push for it. And again, it's one of those diagnoses that you better be sure. You better be sure you're doing that. You can't just be like, hell, maybe. If we're going to pull that trigger, sorry to use an inappropriate term, you know what I mean, though, right? Yeah. You pull the trigger's pulled.
Yeah.
You know, you do that, and we're saying you're an unfit mother. You're doing something wrong. Again, hindsight 2020. Clearly, maybe we should have said something or looked into it further. Knowing what I know now, obviously, different story. Knowing what I knew then, we would have done the same thing 100% of the time. It's so tough to think that a parent doesn't have their child's best interest in mind. It's so difficult to assume that they're lying to me, that they're fabricating. And again, this is probably the presumptuous optimism of a physician. I assume, I'm on the people are good side of things. That being said, I see the underbelly all the time.
Yeah.
You know where I'm coming from. It's there, and I know I see it. But we as a medical community, when people come to us for help, we assume they really need help. Okay. And it's I don't know what it looks like personally. I have not made that phone call. We have had patients historically who have ended up getting that diagnosis. The occasional patient that I worry about, I dot my T's and I cross my I's and I make sure my documentation is pristine, so that if it does come up. And this is one of those where I hope that I documented everything perfectly, that because I know it's gone over with a fine tooth comb. I just, again, doing it all over again, I don't know that I would have done anything differently. Is this going to change my practice in the future? Am I going to start going on social media? I don't know that I want to do that.
I don't know that we're encouraging that. And just to be crystal clear, we're not approaching this investigation at all from the perspective that there was any nefarious intent on the part of anybody at Children's.
I know. I understand that. I just feel awful about it. I mean, it's,
A neurologist had repeatedly insisted that Olivia Gant was not suffering from seizures, and had ordered Kelly to stop giving her Keppra, which is an anti-seizure medication. But even though Kelly had been ordered to stop, she had managed to get a hold of the medication and continued to give it to Olivia. The neurologist had also told Kelly that they didn't believe Olivia was terminally ill. The police interviewed other staff members at the hospital, including 2 pediatric gastrointestinal doctors, who all stated that they believed Olivia not to be terminally ill. And yet, despite the fact that they knew this information, none of them had stepped in to protect Olivia from the dozens of unnecessary procedures and more than 1,000 hospital visits. An occupational therapist who specializes in feeding and eating had treated Olivia. They stated that when they worked with Olivia, she had been able to eat age-appropriate foods during their sessions. The young girl had shown that she could swallow her food correctly and that she appeared to have no issues with eating or digesting. Olivia had done fine during her therapy sessions. Dr. Thomas Walker, a pediatric gastroenterologist, spoke to police about how Kelly would tell hospital staff about her daughter's symptoms and medical history. However, he had not personally seen her exhibit these symptoms, leading him to believe that Olivia's symptoms were not as bad as Kelly was insisting they were. He believed that she was exaggerating. Dr. Walker had witnessed Olivia playing and having fun during her hospital stays, that she seemed like a regular happy child, and not the terminally ill child with horrifying symptoms that Kelly had claimed. It just didn't add up. Dr. Walker had been concerned enough about the situation that he'd reported his suspicions to upper management of the hospital. The hospital's ethics team had studied the case, but they ultimately voted against Dr. Walker and were in favour of Kelly Turner-Gant because the hospital decided to have Olivia's care transferred from Dr. Walker to a different doctor. And this was how Kelly got the DNR order that she was after. This decision directly led to Olivia's starvation and then her death. Had Dr. Walker decided to contact authorities at that time, the young girl might still be alive today. Actually, not only Dr. Walker. He shouldn't get the blame solely for the lack of action here. Any doctor or medical staff that had their own suspicions about Olivia's care, and there were many, they could have spoken up and potentially saved this little girl's life. We are just going to take a quick break now for a word from one of our sponsors.
What if the goal isn't to have life figured out? I'm Amy Savage, host of the Grow As I Go podcast, a space for people who are learning, growing, and navigating life's messy middle one step at a time. Each episode is an honest conversation about the things that we don't talk enough about: self-doubt, rejection, change, relationships, resilience, and all the stories we tell ourselves along the way. Not from the perspective of someone who has all the answers, but as someone who is also figuring it out in real time. So if you're in a season of change, questioning what's next, or simply trying to become more of who you want to be, I'd love to have you join me. Because growth isn't about getting it perfect. It's about growing as you go. Search for Grow As I Go wherever you get your podcasts.
The police had learned another interesting fact about Olivia Gant's death. In 2015, 2 years before Olivia died, the young girl had been sent to the Boston Children's Hospital for a second opinion about her health issues. The doctor learned that Olivia had multiple feeding tubes installed. They recommended that if Olivia's tubes were reversed and she was taken off the heavy narcotics, then Olivia would have lived a full life. This report was sent to the Children's Hospital, Colorado. Unfortunately, the staff decided not to follow the doctor's advice, and they continued to treat Olivia's terminal illness as per Kelly's wishes. January 2022. Kelly Turner-Gant pleaded guilty to a felony charge of child abuse because her negligence had caused Olivia's death. The first-degree murder charge was dropped as part of her plea agreement. She was given a measly 16-year sentence. Kelly also pleaded guilty to the fraud, felony, and theft charges. For these, she was given a 13-year sentence to be served concurrently. Although Kelly had pleaded guilty to the charges, she later said that she was actually innocent of all charges. According to her, the only reason why she pled guilty was because she didn't want to put her family through a longer trial, that it was causing everyone a great deal of stress. Oh, how kind and selfless of her. Kelly's lawyer, Ora Ohanian, argued that her client had not murdered her child. Rather, it was a case of negligent child abuse. Judge Patricia Heron studied Kelly's case and decided against reducing or changing her prison sentence. But since Kelly Turner-Gant is serving both her sentences concurrently, she will likely be released on parole soon. Prosecutor Christopher Gallo stated the following during Kelly's trial. Kelly had engaged in the perpetration of hundreds of thousands of dollars of fraud on organisations whose only purpose in this world is to help sick kids and families in need. Once news had gotten out about Kelly's involvement in her daughter's death, the public was understandably outraged. Munchausen's by proxy is a mental illness. It was Kelly that needed treatment, not her child. People were deeply upset that the hospital had failed Olivia, because Kelly had abused her child, and for 5 years, she'd gotten away with it. Heffelbauer Funeral Home had posted Olivia Gant's obituary on their website. Since the news broke that Kelly had Munchausen's by proxy, they decided to keep the obituary up on their website, which is a sweet memorial they could give Olivia so she wouldn't be forgotten. However, unfortunately, the comments section of this is filled with people writing about Kelly and her illness, instead of focusing on who this was for, and that's Olivia. At the time that the charities had helped Olivia with her bucket list, they'd firmly believed that the young girl was actually sick. However, by the time of Olivia's death, and when it was finally revealed that Kelly had been lying about her daughter's illnesses, in total, Kelly had scammed Medicaid out of a total of about $500,000. She had played up on everyone's sympathy, insisting that Olivia was terminally ill. A great deal of people who had helped Olivia fulfill her wishes were horrified to learn that Kelly had been lying about her daughter's illnesses for years, and that she had forced Olivia to go through so much pain and suffering during her short life. The Children's Hospital Colorado had billed more than $3 million for treating Olivia Gant over the course of 5 years. Olivia had deserved to live a normal childhood, and not to be forced to undergo surgeries and treatments she didn't need. Family attorney Holland Hoskins represented Olivia's sisters and grandparents during the civil lawsuit. She said her and the family's aim was to ensure that the abuse Olivia suffered wouldn't happen to another child, that there needed to be more safeguards in place for young children in Olivia's situation, so they wouldn't be forced into unnecessary surgeries or end up dying because of the hospital staff relying on parents such as Kelly Turner Gant feeding them lies. Holland Hoskins said, and I think this is the perfect way to close out the episode today. She said, even though all Olivia knew was riding in ambulances, staying in hospitals, having tubes in her body and being on pain medications, all the photos and videos tell a story about a resilient young girl who loved life, loved being happy, and loved being the entertainer. Olivia should be here today. If you have your own thoughts and theories on the story we discussed today, or any stories we talk about here on Stolen Lives, please search Stolen Lives Podcast on Facebook, like the page so you don't miss an episode, and join the Stolen Lives discussion group to talk about your thoughts and theories. You can also talk to us on Instagram, Stolen Lives Podcast. If you like what you heard today, we would appreciate it if you share this episode on your social media of choice, and subscribe and leave a positive review on your podcast app. Today's episode was researched and written by me, Ali. Hosting and production was also by me, Ali. Music is by Mayu.